It's been 35 years, and it was a very, in some ways it was a hectic trip. I got sick on my way over on Air Vietnam as we were coming in from Hong Kong into Vietnam, and for 2 days I had a fever and was in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing I brought other people, because they could go out and look at things. But, and then I looked at the data coming in and things of this sort, and went back and reported to the president. But I can't remember what day that was either. It could have been July the 12th or 13th. That's
and what kinds of things did you say to him?
Well, I told him I had the data from the number of positives, and I said, look, it looks as if that the number of people who are using heroin to the point where they can't stop is a lot lower than we were led to believe. It was about 6%. No, it's not 20%. Now, I mean, that's the good part. But I think I might have given the cautions, I don't recall, that, you know, there's a certain uncertainty because it varies from unit to unit, depends on who's leaving that day, which is one of the reasons I said we'll only give out the data once a week, because you could get all kinds of things. One day could be 8%, one day 2%. The Air Corps wasn't using to the same degree, and neither was the Navy, so it was almost a phenomenon among Army enlisted
ground,
men.
Yeah, ground troops.
So,
and was that solely because of availability, or?
My guess, availability. Because it really didn't correlate that much with combat versus support away from combat. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, where you were and who was selling heroin.
Not unlike the drug problem more generally.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So after you had your sort of meeting with the president on that, what did you begin to put into place? How did you respond to the charge?
Well, first thing I guess is you had to hire a few people. I mean, there's a limit to what you can do by yourself. First of all, we had no legislation. This was a White House office by executive order. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the whole budget came out of the White House budget. And in order to get a legislative authority for this special action office, you had to negotiate with Congress. So I had to pick somebody who could take on that task as a general counsel.
And so that's how you got Paul Parita?
Yeah. And then we had to get, there were so many other things. I mean, first of all, we had to think organizationally. How are you going to get this thing done? I mean, if it was oversight, I mean, we had several things to do. We had to, how do we have oversight of all these agencies? And eventually, after a couple of years, have fewer agencies with more clear-cut missions. How do we deal with prevention? How do we get treatment out there? What do we do about methadone now that we've said it ought to be there? Because, and that was a major undertaking all by itself.
Yes.
It was sort of a low-level chaos. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't know. You know, there were lots of people who wanted to come to that office, and yet I have to tell each one of them, look, this is only a 2 to 3 year office. Do you really want to give up that terrific job you have at OEO, or this place, or that place, or the housing? Because this job isn't going to be here in 3 years. I was really committed to this kind of, you know, temporary office with extraordinary power over the agencies shouldn't exist in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody said. I believed it. So I warned everybody. Some believed me, some didn't. Sure. A lot of people knew a lot more about Washington than I did. And then we started testifying. I mean, half the time we were preparing for and giving testimony, because apparently this was a hot topic and everybody wanted to hear about it, and it was good television. And so, you know, in between getting ready for testimony and giving testimony, we had to hire people and tell them what to do, and most of them didn't really know much about the field. So you were training them, even as you said, you know, you're almost teaching them the field. And the real conflict was, if I hire this person from this place, then there's nobody in this place to take the money to make programs grow.
Mm-hmm. So you couldn't rob the agencies.
Well, it wasn't even the agencies. I couldn't even rob the periphery. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were so few people.
Right, right. So you really had to kind of grow a whole field very, very quickly, especially in treatment, right?
Yes.
I mean, that era created the kind of cadre, the
yeah,
treatment as it is today in a
right.
lot of ways.
So, you know, I was always, every time I was thinking of recruiting somebody, I said, but if I recruit that person, it's really good, who would be left in that area that I could give the money to run a good program? Mm-hmm. That was always a conflict. I mean, I found a couple of good people. John Kramer came. He was very knowledgeable from the University of California. I stole Lee Dogoloff, I think, from Bob DuPont, but he had a fairly, you know, good layer of people in Washington. Paul Perito brought a couple of people who were knowledgeable. I mean, the people from the Congress who were working on the narcotics issue at least knew something. Paul brought in a couple of people. Paul recruited somebody who was great at crafting legislation. I mean, he had to draft the bills. And he brought in Grassley Cruz. I mean, Grassley was a superb draftsman of legislation and things of this sort. It's an art unto itself. And then ultimately we had to deal with, how do we both expand and control methadone? Because, and the methadone story is a story all by itself, because the problem was that we already knew of the abuses, that under an IND with nobody having real, basically the FDA has no way of really enforcing the IND once they give it out. So if you get an IND, you could have people who were basically writing for huge amounts of methadone. You could have people, they were already for-profit groups. I mean, there were people giving out 300 milligrams at a time. Well, you know, 100 milligrams is a lethal dose.
Yeah.
So if somebody sells a 300 milligram bottle, there are going to be several overdose deaths. And there were people in New York, and this is a story probably that's fairly well known, that Michael Baden, who was the assistant to the coroner in New York, to the medical examiner's office, was married to one of the people in the therapeutic community who was anti-methadone. So he did something that has for years plagued the field. He defined a methadone-related death as he detected methadone in somebody's body. I mean, if you were walking across the street in New York and were hit by a bus, and you'd been on a methadone, you were a methadone-related death. And he also had connections with the New York Times, and he got I guess the guy's name was Myron something. One can look that up. I can't remember Myron's last name. But, and they had these headlines, methadone deaths now exceed heroin deaths, mm-hmm. all kinds of things. So the whole drama of what you talked about is this robbery was played out in the New York Times headlines. And it wasn't always played out fairly. But you did know that if there are enough methadone overdose deaths as a result of diversion, that the availability of methadone to treat the heroin addicts would be either curtailed or eliminated. I mean, we were one of the few countries at that time that had this as policy. The great liberal European countries had not done that. Germany, all these places. You know, England had its own little system, but we were nowhere. It was not particularly well organized, thought through. Anyway, where does that leave us? So we had to craft something that would give us some way of saying to people, you know, methadone is useful, but within these parameters. And that is a deviation from FDA procedure. You know, when you approve a drug, you're essentially saying, doctor, this drug is available. And doctors are free to use it off-label.
Yes.
And there is no penalty. It's medical judgment. Well, how do you tell a doctor that above a certain dose, you know, you don't have full authority? Or you can use it, but you can't decide how much people can take home. You can use it, but only if you do a certain amount of testing and provide other things. How do you do that?
And you run the risk of being accused of interfering with the practice of
oh,
medicine.
Oh, there's no question about it. You're justly accused. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, we did interfere with the practice of medicine in this area. It was precedent-breaking in some degree. Mm-hmm. This was called a hybrid IND approval. It was, you know, FDA approval. So it was, Peter Hutt from the FDA actually crafted the concept. And what was absolutely...
Is that H-U-T?
H-U-T-T. Brilliant lawyer. He was working for FDA at the time. He since went on to make his money in the law firms. But I think he's still around. But I did tell the people at the FDA, look, we need to do this. And if you want it in writing, I'll give it to you in writing. But I will take the full weight of this. If anything goes wrong with this, they'll fire me. And I will say you had nothing to do with it. I ordered you to do this.
So you had the authority to order the
Not
FDA
really,
to do that?
But I was the White House.
So how did, what was your relationship then like with FDA?
Well, I told them honestly, this has to be done. But I'll take full responsibility. I will, you will not be the patsy. Somebody needs to fall on their sword, it will be me. I didn't want to be there. I mean, the FDA commissioner moves on to very, very lucrative jobs. So anyway, I just wanted to go back and run a program.
Had your own views on maintenance changed?
I've been running maintenance for almost 5 years in Illinois. Have they since then? Well, remember, the regs that we put in 1972 were put in as regulations and not into legislation because we thought that regulations could be more flexible and could change with the times. They didn't. Apparently, what happened was every time that the government wanted to change them and improve them, you had the bureaucracies, both the DEA and the providers protecting their vested interest by keeping everything the way it was. Nobody wanted to change.
Yeah.
I tried very mightily when I went back into government to get it to be changed. And the remarkable thing was the degree to which the franchise holders, the methadone programs, wanted it just the way it was. I mean, it took almost 10 years to get it moved to a kind of accreditation from every little detail was a regulation. I mean, technically, if you break a government regulation, you can be prosecuted. But a guideline under accreditation is, you could lose your accreditation, but you certainly are not, you can't be prosecuted. But, the DEA got control over the methadone programs by separate legislation after I left. They were not involved during my time there.
What was your relationship like with the, DEA was kind of...
I had a good relationship with all the law enforcement people. I knew Miles Ambrose and all those guys. And as a matter of fact, we talked about what should be their priority? Some methadone leakage or the heroin? Mm-hmm. And they realized that, look, when somebody sells methadone, they're usually selling it to another addict who can't get into a program. Now, this should not be where you ought to be putting your resources. And for the year or two I was there, that's exactly what happened. I mean, it wasn't a good idea for people to sell methadone. I mean, you can sell it to somebody who's not tolerant, bad things can happen. But there was still this drama being played out in the newspapers about methadone deaths, methadone zombies, this kind of thing. I mean, it really didn't end for that period of time. And there were people who were previously getting money to run rap groups and things of this sort who felt threatened because they didn't have any results. They couldn't show that people were doing better. So their attack was on the people, you know, doctors who had the credentials to run the programs, because essentially the doctors were getting the money that prior to that time they were getting.
Yes.
So some of these attacks, you know, weren't out of pure principle.
There were vested interests involved in a very...
Well, there might have been some people who saw this in political terms, but you got the feeling that there were other motives as well.
Mm-hmm. So the methadone, the entire issue of how to control and expand methadone was, would you say, one of your primary activities at SODEP?
No, it wasn't primary, but it was very time consuming. I mean, I'm sure that we could have spent, you know, full time at it for a while. I mean, you had to craft something, you had to get the thing balanced, you had to get this innovative stuff in, you had to really look at what is it that we really expect. Because, I mean, the big cry was all you want to do is give methadone, and this is treatment. And we have to have counseling, and you have to have this, and you have to have that. I mean, we didn't want just people giving only methadone, at least at that time. Mm-hmm. Because what we knew to be effective was methadone combined with counseling. Now, if it should later turn out that the counseling doesn't do anything, only the methadone does, then the changes in regulations sort of will, you know, reflect that. Well, they actually never did. I haven't yet.
Yeah.
And it could very well be. I mean, we have data that suggests that, at least here in Baltimore, the counseling at its current level doesn't have that much of an impact. Mm-hmm. It may very well be because this is a result of essentially starving the programs. I mean, inflation has eroded the actual resources per patient on methadone. You know,
yes.
If you raise the budget by, during the Carter years, remember the inflation was 12-13%? Well, if you hold the budget constant, at the end of 4 years of that, you've cut the buying power of the programs in half.
I'm sure you hear much more than I do the lives of treatment of counselors, you know, being fairly pressured.
They are pressured, and they're pressured too much, and they've become progressively more pressured. And so you get people burning out. There was always some burnout. I mean, you had tough people to work with. But, you know, maybe we, you know, it's a reflection of two attitudes. I don't think Jimmy Carter was that supportive of it. And certainly Ronald Reagan was not. He was anti-methadone. I mean, but so you really had, you know, you could say you had 12 years of eroding support. Now, a lot of support came from the state, but there are some states that were so anti-methadone that they don't pay for it at all unless you can pay for it yourself. California, for example, has almost all self-pay. And that's another way to deal with something you don't like. You say, well, you can have it, but we don't subsidize it. Now, it turns out that a lot of people can't afford to pay. Or they feel so angry that, you know, why should I take something that doesn't make me feel great like heroin does and pay for it? You want me to give up my heroin, you've got to give it to me for free. I mean, there are certain attitudinal kinds of things that, you know, that are prevalent. But that has nothing to do with what happened 35 years ago. 35 years ago, the issue was we are taking this unusual step of actually regulating the practice of medicine. And this generated anger from people with methadone. It angered everybody not working with methadone because they didn't want it at all. And yet we felt that if this was going to have enough time to demonstrate its general efficacy, it was necessary. I don't know whether we were right or wrong or how it would have worked out differently, but at least the overdose deaths were kept to a minimum, the diversion was kept to a reasonable level, and enough people found benefit in the program that continued.
How fast did the scale up happen? Like, when you first came into the position, how many methadone programs
were there? Well, I have that someplace. I could give you some books that have that in it.
So you don't, I thought maybe you might.
No, I don't keep that
narrative in your head about that or something.
No, I mean, I'm sure it quadrupled.
So what else were you doing in that first sort of flush of enthusiasm?
The military didn't go away. Yeah. Everybody wanted to hear about it, what was happening, what are you doing about getting people into the VA, and I heard about this guy who, you know, came back, but the VA didn't admit him, or the VA only kept him 5 days, and so all of this was newsworthy and required attention. The VA has a special system as well. You may know about this, that you give the money to the director, and it's his task to decide how best to use it, no matter how you try to earmark it. The directors have autonomy. So the money you would give them for a drug program might not turn into a drug program.
And there was no accountability.
There was in this case because we sent people out. That was the whole idea. You know, and if we found places that were not taking the resources and using them in how they were, we would go to the administrator of the veterans and things and say, we need to talk. Which was not a good thing to hear from the White House in those days. Because Nixon wanted me to be his son of a bitch. I mean, he announced that. That's not my style, but that if that's your mission, kill people. Knock heads together. He really kill people. I mean, he really felt that the bureaucracy was, and it is, always trying to be more or less autonomous. It sort of resents anybody at the White House telling them what to do. It probably is true of all the departments, not just the Department of Defense and other. Anyway, so yes, we could go out, we could talk, we could look, and you had to send people, and you had to get their reports. So we had the military continued to be an issue for at least the first year. You know, certainly for the first 6 months or so. All the data and testimony, and it's all there in the congressional record. What did we find? What was going on now? We had lots of things to go on. I had discussions with Harold Hughes up until Nixon changed. You know, asked for a change in the Code of Military Justice. So they weren't giving dishonorable discharges and bad conduct discharges. There had been maybe a couple of thousand people, maybe a couple of hundred, I don't remember, with bad conduct discharges or dishonorable discharges. Well, you know, that meant they weren't eligible for any treatment, the VA and everything else. And, you know, if that was the only reason, it sounded like a penalty that was set up to deter drug use, but particularly wasn't effective. And given what happened on June the 17th, it looked like some justice needed to, that justice would require that they be adjusted. That had to be done.
So, and how quickly was that accomplished?
It was accomplished over the next year or so, to the best of my knowledge. Somebody had to look over that. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to be on top of that. What should the military do now? Well, remember, the plan was that after we do the DROS testing, what about the guys who just got there? Are they going to use heroin today? No, we had to do more testing. We had to test in other parts of the country. How do we know that the testing that's being done by the various clinics does any good? We had to set up a laboratory to control the quality of the urine testing done in various programs. Mm-hmm. That had to be done. Then the president told me when I reported to him, you've got to write a book about this Vietnam experience. Well, I didn't exactly have time, but I knew what we had to do, and I hired Lee Robbins. Mm-hmm. And I told her to do it. Well, somebody had to run interference with her, for her, mm-hmm. to say to the military, we really want you to give her the records, because they were afraid of what they were going to find. I had to say that to the VA, I had to say that to Selective Service, because she had to pull a control sample.
Had you worked with her before?
I had never worked with her. Danny Friedman told me about her. I had known of her, and I read her work, but never really knew her very well. She's a lovely lady, I mean, just charming and smart. And so she put that team together, but somebody had to, this was a task. Somebody had to make sure that nobody threw closed doors so she couldn't get the data. What else? So there was methadone, and there was this, and there was that.
What role did you play in the closure of Lexington?
I had it closed.
When did that come up? And
I don't remember. I don't remember exactly what meeting, but basically they were calling that research.
They meaning the people at
the NIMH.
Or NIMH.
NIMH, it became a division
the
of NIMH.
Research Center.
Went under the division of DINADA, or some
yes.
division of America. And they decided not to admit people, you know, before people could come from any part of the country and get admitted for treatment. Well, now they weren't doing that. Now it was a research facility.
Well, wasn't that because of civil commitment?
Whatever it was for. The point is I had data that Wallace Mandel had developed that said, if you look at civil commitment, mm-hmm. and you look at the people, I have that report downstairs, which you're welcome to look at. And I saw it almost the first day that I got there, because we had some of the documents. It said, if what they did is that they, when people were civilly committed, they interviewed them and they decided suitable for treatment and not suitable for treatment. And they would try to get the most motivated people into the program, and those who weren't really motivated were rejected. And Mandel did a follow-up a year later, and compared the people who were treated for 6 months at Lexington and got treatment in the community for another 6 months with people who had been rejected. And the drug use rates were the same. That doesn't sound like a good investment. If the least motivated are doing as well as those you took in, you know, now you have to understand the size of the research budget. It was very small relative to the $1 billion a year they have now. I mean, we're talking maybe they had, well, I won't tell you, but they really, a lot of what they called drug abuse research was going into things that were a stretch. I mean, it wasn't that it wasn't good research, it just wasn't on drug abuse. So, and it may be that basically there weren't people interested in drug. What was not a high prestige area, so, you know, people in psychiatry and things of this sort were much more interested in depression and, you know, schizophrenia and other things, and, mm-hmm. you know, and they may have been very good grants. So, well, it's about a drug, right? That's anyway, so I said, look, this is a terrific prison. It's nice as a prison. I'd been there for 2 years. You know, as a farm and a golf course and everything else, it's a great prison. It's a lousy hospital. Doesn't get any results. And you're calling it research. Well, you know, how long can we keep this up? Well, they would have kept it up forever, because bureaucracies always do. I said, we have a chance now because they need more prison space. Let's turn it into a prison. And let's take this $18 million and move it over to the extramural program and give out some grants to people who will do other things. Well, that caused great consternation on a lot of parts, but to me, it made sense.
Did the ARC?
The ARC was not part of that.
It didn't factor into it
no,
at all.
Just the hospital part. The ARC was actually got a very substantial increase in its budget. And there would still be prisoners there. And there would still be drug addict prisoners. And they could still recruit, and they did. I mean, this was 1972, and they didn't stop until 1976. So they could continue to send addicted federal prisoners there. That's fine. It was very nice for them. But just don't take the money for drug abuse research and say this is where it is, because your output is zero. And
who else opposed that decision? What kind of flack did you get?
We got flack from the people, the congressmen and the other people who didn't want to work in a prison. They wanted to work in a hospital. It was a prison. So we got all kinds of flack from people in Texas because it affected Fort Worth as well as Lexington. I mean, there were...
So my sense, as you probably know, is that civil commitment, NARA, really was the undoing of Fort Worth and Lexington, in the sense that it put a whole different patient sort of base there.
Well, yes and no. Without civil commitment, once you had treatment in the community that often was more effective, why would anybody drag themselves over there to Lexington? So it would empty hospitals. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would anybody go from California to
and
Fort Worth?
And it did, and the census really did go down at Lexington, at least.
I don't know what happened to the census
sure
until
Fort
they
Worth.
Had the civil commitment, but once you're saying we have treatment in the community, that, you know, when you really want to get treatment, go knock on that door, take a bus, and not get on a bus and travel 2 days to Fort Worth from Los Angeles. Why do you have two federal hospitals when you have treatment, you know, in your community? And that was the shift. That, you know, that there aren't, if the N is so small that, you know, no city needs to have any treatment because we'll send them all to Lexington, then fine, have one place. I mean, we only had one leprosarium, I guess, in Louisiana. But this was a somewhat wider problem. And so, no matter how you look at it, whether it's civil commitment or other kinds of things, and civil commitment is expensive stuff. You have lawyers and you have judges and you have all of this stuff, and you have people banging on the treatment programs, trying to get into the programs. Why do you have to spend money on compelling other people to go into treatment when so many people want it? I mean, it may have been a wrong decision, but I just saw it that way at the time.
Do you think it was a wrong decision now?
No, but who knows what the historians will think.
I don't think it was a wrong decision.
I mean, I didn't want everybody to be unemployed by closing it down, and I didn't think that I could work a deal with the Bureau of Prisons.
So what did you do with the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, they were willing to take it over rather than build a brand new prison.
Now, did you go to Norm Carlson, or how did...
We sent somebody to Norm Carlson.
Do you remember how that happened? Because that has been very hard for us historians to figure out.
Well, maybe you could ask Paul.
Yeah.
Maybe you could ask Jeff. Yeah. I mean, in other words, some things... You know, I couldn't do everything myself.
Right.
I could make a decision, but, you know, this is what we ought to do. But then working out the details, you know, that's why we had people. I mean, they were able people.
Wasn't Katzenmeier involved, too, in pressuring Carlson to close Lexington?
He might have been.
Or to take...
Oh, well, that was afterward. Katzenmeier, I think, didn't he work for... He worked for Johnson. I thought Katzenmeier...
Well, now, see, I should...
No, wait a second.
My
no, 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 you're talking about the Attorney General. Or are you talking about Kastenmeier?
Kastenmeier, I'm sorry.
Ah, the Kastenmeier.
Kastenmeier.
Kastenmeier was a representative from Wisconsin.
Right, and he was involved in pressuring around prison research.
Yeah, but that was after my time.
He was also involved with Carlson.
He could have been.
Trying to get Carlson to move on Lexington.
But it was after my time. I know.
I don't know.
We still get Christmas cards from
him. When did you leave? When?
73. End of 73.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, when also you also went to New York City to speak with Governor Rockefeller during the time when you were still at SEODEP, right?
Yeah.
And what was the occasion?
Well, I was trying to really get him to rethink this, the draconian penalties under the Rockefeller laws that he was going to propose. And there were several problems with it, in addition to the fact that, you know, at some point, the penalties he were proposing were so draconian that I was concerned that, you know, rather than having somebody, you know, turn state's evidence and report to somebody who would then go to prison with no parole for the rest of their life, he'd get everybody murdered. But also that, I didn't see that the penalties would necessarily accomplish what he wanted. But I was unsuccessful. I mean, this is what he was going to do, that was it. But that was my mission.
But, and why was it important, I mean, for someone in your role to have done that? You must have seen it as a pretty serious step that New York was taking.
Well, these things tend to have, you know, snowball effects, if you will. You know, well, we can't be softer on drugs than New York. There's a history of this. You know, Anslinger convinced Ohio to have the most draconian penalties in the country. And you found all kinds of people moving from Ohio to Pennsylvania, moving from Ohio to Indiana. I mean, I guess this was about 56. He was bragging about the penalties in Ohio. So you have this effect of having, you know, drug users in New York moving all over the country. I mean, that's another effect. But also, I was concerned about the total cost of dealing with a drug problem. And I didn't believe that it made logical sense to put the cost of incarceration off the books. The cost of dealing with the problem includes the cost of incarceration. And as you have more and more minimum penalties and keep people longer and longer, you're raising those costs. And I just thought, what's the evidence that if you raise it from 20 years to 40 years, you're going to have more deterrence? You will have 20 more years of incarceration, and I know what that costs, because we continue to look at the costs of one option versus another. We knew what treatment costs, we knew what other things cost, and this, to me, was a redistribution of resources in a way.
And an externalization of that cost, so it was no longer...
Well, I was hoping at least you'd be honest and keep that on the books. Mm-hmm. So this is what the drug problem is costing us. Then you could look and see it's all imprisonment. Well, if we cut that down, you could put more into prevention, you could put more into other things. I don't know. At some point, they had it on, and then they decided to take it off. And I really don't know how they're treating it currently. Whether or not all of the people that they have in the state and federal prison system that are there for drug things are actually counted as part of the cost of the overall drug problem. I think in some kinds of accounting that people do, it is. But sometimes at the federal level, when they talk about it, their curves are different.
Right. Could you also talk a little bit about SEODEP's education and prevention efforts?
Well, yeah. There was a lot of pressure on us to put into schools all kinds of curricula. Tell people about drugs, explain it, educate. All the data I had up to that time suggested that this had no impact. Mm-hmm. Some data suggested it made people more sophisticated and actually increased drug use. So I thought, you know, the least I can do is not make things worse. And even some of the public service ads looked like they were counterproductive. They made people more aware and not necessarily less likely to use. So I said, the least we should do is have a little bit of a moratorium until we can find out what's effective. I mean, the whole mantra of what we did in that report is you need to know what works.
Yes.
And I didn't know that any of these ads, this is your brain on drugs, maybe it does work, maybe it doesn't. But we ought to know before you decide to do it. I mean, any message is not necessarily a useful or an effective message, even, no matter how clever it may seem to the people who make the ads. So we did not do a lot in the area of direct, let's say, you know, K-12 prevention or public service ads, but we did try to start the process of asking, do they work? What works? The one thing we did do is say medical schools ought to be teaching doctors something about addiction. Yeah. There, the issue wasn't much of trying to keep people from using drugs, but to teach people how to deal with people who already had drugs. So the career teachers was an initiative that we put in place. We might have done other things, but they were not things that, you know, I necessarily, they were loomed high on my list of priorities.
And did SEODEP actually fund research?
We did fund some research. We had our own little budget. It was quite small.
And who'd you fund? Do you remember what?
Well, I think we funded some research on naltrexone. We paid part of the cost of the Vietnam follow-up study. We got some money from other people as well.
Did you fund any receptor research?
Not directly.
Not directly.
We didn't have a whole grant program was competitive.
Yeah.
What happened was basically we went to the NIH and said, look, we're not trying to fire anybody. But what you call drug abuse research, and this is not just me, I had a couple of people who were fairly good. What you call drug abuse research is not drug abuse research, and you know it. I knew the people, I'm not going to mention them. I said, look, we're going to give you another $10 million. But if you divert this to your other favorite topics in psychiatry, then Sounds like the Godfather. Then I do not forgive.
So this is it's NIMH.
Yes.
That you're really
still NIMH. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
You remember that line?
Yes.
If he should fall off a curve.
So did they
yes.
Obey?
Absolutely. That's how. That was the first big round of really drug abuse research centers and things like this.
Yes, yeah. So the tensions between SEODEP and NIMH, they sort of resolved?
No. Or it was never a resolution because, in a sense, every agency, it doesn't make a difference which one, resents anybody who tries to tell the head of that agency what to do, other than the head of that agency. It's just the way it seems to be. Just seems to be the way it is. But a major area of tension was probably that they wanted to put, at least the head of NIMH wanted to put the drug abuse treatment money into the community mental health centers. That was their favorite vehicle. I happen to believe, and I must say it was personal, that what I had witnessed was that when you gave them the money, they did not treat addicts. They treated the people that they liked to treat. And so, it was, how should we say, no quid pro quo. Thank you for the money, but we'll treat who we want to treat. And they didn't have either the expertise, they didn't have, it was still, this was 71, it was still dominated by people with a more or less dynamic view of psychiatry. They were the people who ran these things. And so they had, you know, sociologic views and analytic views, but nobody wanted to say, you know, more cognitive stuff that is now proven to be what works. And I just felt that, you know, if we put the money there, it'll get dissipated. And that's where they wanted the money. And we didn't want the money there. So the money for treatment, we wanted directed toward programs that would deal with addicts.
Mm-hmm. Was there, within SAODEP, I mean, I understand that you didn't have money for research in a very basic sort of way, but was there any kind of basic versus clinical kind of split?
Not within SAODEP. It may have been that we would have liked to have seen a little bit more work on outcomes so that we could look at fine-tuning what was being funded on the treatment side. And some people, Biff Bunny, wanted to do more on the basic side. But, you know, at the end of the time, you know, it wasn't enough to really fight about.
Yeah.
That wasn't the big fight.
Yeah.
Because whatever would happen would have been 3 years down the pike anyway.
Yeah.
Now, they had their own beliefs on who was going to do their outcome research. And I had participated in some of it, and I just didn't think that what they were going to do was, I mean, they had this large program that was gathering data, and they already had an N of 55,000, but they wanted to keep funding it. I said, you have 55,000 people, you should have enough data to talk about outcomes. Mm-hmm. Let's start on another set of projects. And that was difficult because, after all, there's sort of a kind of a, I wouldn't say a symbiosis or a kind of a illicit liaison, but the project directors get sort of married in certain ways to the people they fund, and relationships tend to cloud things. There was a little tension over that. I mean, they had hired somebody, and this was when I was still in Illinois, who was giving us forms to fill out, and everybody you admitted, you had this 8-page form, and you would send that in. And, you know, I didn't really have much confidence in how, since you never got any feedback from me, how well it was being done in the clinics. It couldn't be done centrally. It had to be done where you interviewed the people. And it's very difficult to get people to fill out all those little blocks and things of this sort and ask all those questions. The patients don't want to answer them. And since it goes away, you don't use it clinically. So it's just an extra burden with no feedback. And when the end got up, as I said, to about 50,000 of these interviews, I said, it's time we either got some results or you funded other things. And then there were more than enough areas, you know, for tension. I mean, I'm sure that they weren't happy with the decision about their clinical research facility at Lexington. Did displace some people, the doctors who were there doing so-called research. Some of whom were friends of mine. They weren't happy with not putting all their money into the clinical, into the community health centers. They weren't happy with methadone, by the way.
Yeah.
So many areas of, you could say, conflict. And, you know, they would say, oh, the White House is all about a magic bullet. Well, yeah, there was a distortion. I mean, we never thought methadone was a magic bullet, but certainly had some utility, which they didn't think. And so, I mean, there might have been bruised feelings of just overriding their views. Have you read their in-house report?
The NIMH report?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's clear that they had a more sociologic view. That
yes.
Nothing could be done until you right all the wrongs in society, until there's equality and justice and no discrimination. Well, you know, that's almost it's both utopian and nihilistic. Nothing's going to work until we do these things, because this is the root core of things. And you know, we did think you could do some things, even though it was not within our power, to bring light, justice, and fairness to all people.
Right, right. I mean, you did have a more pragmatic approach that could be put into practice, whereas they had a different orientation.
Yeah, it was somewhat utopian. I mean, maybe they're right. Maybe in a world where everybody is happy and lives in the suburbs and things of the sort, you'd never have any. I mean, we know that nobody in the suburbs where everybody is affluent ever uses heroin, right? We know that.
Or methamphetamine.
Or methamphetamine. Or cannabis, or any of this. And it was an interesting view that, you know, I, you know, respectfully declined to accept in toto. And said there are a few things we probably can do.
So, in the time that you were there, you did accomplish a few things. Had you intended to stay until the sunset?
No, I was asked after the election. You know, everybody was asked to submit their resignation, and I was supposed to start discharging the people who had worked 18 and 20 hours a day for me. I couldn't do that. That's not the way you reward people who really put themselves out. I didn't want that. And besides which, I had made myself, I guess, persona non grata, because when Nixon decided that he would have minimum mandatories because he didn't want to be outflanked by Nelson Rockefeller, I wrote a memo that said, you know, this, we don't agree. And that's forbidden.
So had you decided before that, did you decide to use the occasion to make clear your views on mandatory minimums? Had you already decided to leave, or...?
No, I hadn't decided to leave. I was a little ambivalent, because this was 73, and another Goodman and Gilman chapter was coming up. I knew you couldn't do it from the White House.
And you were that committed to Goodman and Gilman that you really wanted to do that?
After, well, it was 65, 70, it wasn't a matter of that committed, but, you know, you were sort of involved.
Did your White House experience change the Goodman and Gilman chapter in any way?
Did it? Yeah, well, I think the experience changes the person and the amount that you can concentrate, you know. What changed was, I guess, in 74, they were very busy putting away people that I had known very well and prosecuting them. And it leaves you a little demoralized.
Yes.
But one moves on. No, it did not. I mean, I think that compared to the second edition, where I was in Illinois and was still active in academics, if you will, to a degree, anyway, to a greater degree, I felt less prepared. I mean, 2 years of looking at Vietnam and regulations and this and that and the other thing is not keeping up with the literature. Now, the literature itself, by 75, had not yet, or 74, remember, you have to turn this in 74, so you have to begin in 73. At least I did. Some people can write these things faster, or better than I am. But, you know, the literature had not yet felt the impact of the research since then. It was not growing logarithmically. So it wasn't impossible to deal with it.
Yeah, so the sort of sudden explosion of a lot of interest in the area hadn't yet really trickled into the literature.
Well, all the grants were made in roughly 71, 72, so nothing was in the literature.
Right.
By 74, maybe a couple of papers.
Yeah.
There was still only a handful of specialty journals and a few other things. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was still doable.
Yeah.
I don't know how people do it now. I just, there are just too many specialty journals and too many things come out. There's too much stuff. Yeah, it's just don't know how people are able to decide what's important.
Yes.
I suspect that they take whatever's written and they tweak it.
When did you bring Bill Martin in to the Goodman and Gilman chapters?
I don't know whether it was 75 or...
It may have been 1980, not until 1980.
No, it may have been before. I'll tell you when. I think it was 75. It wasn't in 1970. I think it was in 75. And I think the reason was that Bill Martin was really the first person to talk about receptors. Mm-hmm. Hadn't been discovered, but he predicted them. Yeah. And 71, was it? Probably the 71 to 73 was when they began to really talk about the discovery of the opiate receptors and when the opiate pharmacology and things of this sort became more molecular. And Bill was working full time at this stuff. This was what he did. And I just felt that, you know, I had lost, you know, as they say in sport, I'd lost a step or two. It's the cost of being, for me at least, of, you know, taking on administrative responsibilities. I needed that. And I needed him for the opiate chapter. I think I still wrote, if I'm not mistaken, I still wrote the drug abuse chapter myself.
Yes, I think that's right.
And, you know, I don't know why, you know, I got, you know, sort of identified with that, but, you know, it was something that you didn't have to be ambivalent about. You were always, you know, you worked for Nixon, you did this, you did that, you weren't always sure that it was something you should be particularly proud of. I mean, we're all, you know, it's impossible to really do things without knowing that, you know, you make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
The chapters, you could say, yeah, they were fine. They were good. Maybe I left something out, but you can't put everything in. That was fine. But for me, they're a lot of work. And I may be too obsessive about trying to decide whether you put in this fact or that fact, given the limitations of space. Anyway, that was one issue. The other issue is that, you know, I still had some, I guess I was tenured at the University of Chicago and had the option of going back, but not if you drag it out indefinitely.
Yeah.
So I'd been away for 2 years. And so I was not particularly unhappy about leaving. I would have liked to have left under better circumstances. I would like to have left, you know, with the president said, okay, you disagree with me, but I still appreciate what you did. They reacted, I thought, in a petty way. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to do that kind of stuff, I didn't leak this to the papers, somebody else did. So be it.
Was it, in retrospect, the right issue to have done that with?
There were people like Grasty and others, you know, the lawyers who felt that this was just the wrong thing. You got to take a stand. And, you know, I respected these people a lot. I mean, true, they were more libertarian than I was, but there are people who say that there's something about civil rights and justice that are important. And, you know, if I had expected the same, you know, I guess if you're asking me, if you'd known that one of your staff would leak it in a way that would cause you to be in great difficulty, would you have still done it? You know, I'd have to think about that. You know, would you, you know. But I will tell you this, I think that once the crisis was over, the crisis being Vietnam, you know, heroin deaths, everything, things started to settle down, it was clear that, you know, that we had our one bite at the apple and that they were going back to law enforcement. Law enforcement was going to be back, you know, as the central focus of how you deal with drugs. So, you know, if your star is declining, it's time to go. That may be sad, you know, whether or not had to do with my shortcomings as a bureaucrat, I don't know, probably. But at any rate, you know, that I tried never to think of myself as being that person. I mean, you really have to understand that, you know, it's, my father used to tell stories about, you know, the suit, you know, that you never confuse yourself with, you know, the role that people give you to play.
Uh-huh. You know, to never confuse yourself, who you are.
Yeah.
With who you're supposed to act like.
Yes. I didn't change that. Look. Gave me this job, I have to wear this suit. But, you know, you have to take the suit off. I haven't changed that much. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I never felt comfortable in all of the trappings and this and that. Never felt comfortable with, you know, it just wasn't me. I felt much more comfortable, you know, when I was in Illinois doing other things, you know.
As a clinician?
I wasn't as a clinician, it was just, I didn't like moving in those circles. I mean, it's hard to say. There are people who feel comfortable, isn't it wonderful? You walk in out of White House mess and this and that. And I never really felt that this was anything more than a temporary task that I had to get over with.
Yeah.
And
another thing to ask you about in terms of Nixonian drug policy, and that is, go back, if you can, to the development of the Controlled Substances Act, and did you follow that?
Sure, I was part of that.
And can you talk about your role in it?
I was a great antagonist to the Justice Department.
How so?
Well, because, you know, what they wanted was the power to determine where drugs went, and they wanted the power to engage in, I guess it was, the education and dissemination. I mean, it didn't say that the Attorney General may, it said the Attorney General shall do certain things. And these were things that I just didn't have any confidence that they would do with any kind of scientific integrity. They had a history of exaggerating, you know, adverse effects, of making things up, of, you know, I mean, there's a certain spin you can put on the data, but at a certain point you're not spinning it, you're lying. And to say, we're going to do this when this is the task of the health department. You know, I got up and I said exactly what I just said there, that this is just unacceptable. I might have been more articulate back in those days, but, you know, I really, you know, said these things, and, you know, eventually, I think they made some kind of modifications. But I talked to Mike Sonnenreich, who was on that side at the time.
Sure. And were you concerned about who would have decision-making authority under the CSA?
Sure.
Was that the issue?
Absolutely. I mean, I like the idea that we had, instead of a Manichaean, it's either bad or it's good, which was what you had under the old things, that we have a gradation. Mm-hmm. That made sense. that was a step forward, that there's some drugs that are very dangerous and there's some that are minimally dangerous, and we ought to be able to do that. But I really felt that that is a decision that needs to be made in a coordinated way, with health data, with justice data, and people looking honestly at the data.
Yeah.
The WHO did that. I mean, we took all the data and we tried to interpret it reasonably. And as I told you about that, I was talking to a class earlier today, that the UN group, you know, looked only at, we heard a bad thing, so let's do this, the Vienna group. And not, what does that do to the utility of the drug for terms of treatment and other things? So trying to look at all of the issues, both the consequences of classification as well as some of the benefits of shifting it. I didn't trust entirely to our law enforcement.
Were you at all concerned about the potential impact of the CSA on research?
At the time, no. But I suppose I should have been. I mean, I suppose that if you put everything in Schedule 1, then you can't get access to it unless the DEA or someplace like that. It wasn't the DEA. The Bureau of Narcotics says you can have some. And they have not been very cooperative with a lot of people for a long time.
Although they have been very cooperative with some, like Seavers.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know what price those people had to pay to be in the good graces of the BNDD, but I think that I wasn't that concerned about research at that point. And I don't, as I don't recall that that was my major concern, that we wouldn't be able to get new drugs to do this, because I can't tell you why. Maybe it's because I wasn't working with a lot of compounds of that sort, but I just don't recall that was the major concern.
I'm also curious about whether you thought at the time about whether the CSA would have adverse effects on pain management and on how doctors dealt with chronic pain. And
I don't think that it would have. I mean, they weren't really doing anything with the opiates were going to be where they were, and that was appropriate. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that was a big issue. I think a lot has to do in many of these things with how these laws are administered, not the nominal, you know, du jour
right.
way it's done, but what actually, how they're interpreted.
Yes. Yes. You wrote an article in 1985 about scheduling. Do you remember that article? It contains a poignant vignette about your father's death.
Well, my father and my father-in-law.
Both. Both.
Yeah, both. Same thing happened to both of them.
Yeah. In terms of under medication?
Yes.
So you must have had some concerns.
Well, but it wasn't a concern about the CSA. I mean, you know, what could you do with the CSA that would change the attitude of doctors, mm-hmm. and try to understand where that attitude comes from? I mean, maybe you could, we were doing things that was, that one of the things is you write Goodman and Gilman and you put that in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you talk about that, and you do other things. But clearly if you have local people or other people who are, you know, intimidating doctors who treat pain, then nothing you do about the CSA is going to do anything.
Yeah, so it's more of a the interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Morphine
and the interaction between.
Yeah, morphine is a drug that causes addiction and also relieves pain. Now, what do you want to do about it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What should we do? How do we balance those? It's still an issue. Still has to be dealt with. It's probably going to be one of the questions on my midterm exam for my students, I think. They're going to talk about prescription drug abuse and how we balance this. And let them try to think about it. It's not an easy kind of thing. In every profession, whether it's the DEA agent or the local guy on the board at the state medical board, or the doctor. They're mavericks, and they're bad actors. You'll find doctors that, some are dumb, some are debilitated. I mean, they can write a script for morphine, they'll still have money coming in, they can't do much else. So you have all kinds of issues of dishonest people. And the response to each of them is a little different. I mean, if you have a doctor who's way over the hill and all he's doing is writing prescriptions because that's, I guess you have to get him to retire somehow. Should you put him in prison? Well, the British at one time said, the way they get you the attention of the Navy is you hang an admiral in the public square from time to time. I don't know where I heard that, but, we do that with white collar crime and things. This
sure.
The question, is that was Anslinger's technique, is to advertise the prosecution of a physician, and thereby intimidate all physicians who were exceeding what he thought was appropriate medical care. But you need to have some lines beyond which you don't want the physician to cross. On the other hand, you don't want them to be so intimidated that people are really in pain. I don't have, in that area, any magic, clear-cut solution to say, aha, I have this special magnifying glass, I can put it on the doctor and immediately tell whether it's proper or improper. It's not easy, but it is a task that we continue to return to. It has to be dealt with. It wasn't, that was not my concern about the CSA. The CSA had to do, I think, with something about the other responsibilities that they wanted to assign to the Attorney General that had more to do with, it may have to do with research, it may have to do with education, things of that sort, that looked much more properly belonging to the Department of Health and Education. But I think eventually they crafted something that was kind of a compromise with the help of the Senate. There was a lot of lobbying.
Mm-hmm. And were you part of that?
Well, I was invited to meetings where they presented their views, and then I got up and told them my views. Why they invited me, I don't know, because I certainly, I don't know why. Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, it might have been early in 1970, or it might have even been in 69. Mm-hmm. Maybe because I was working in the area, maybe because I wrote Goodman and Gilman, I don't know.
We actually had not realized that you had been that directly involved. So I'm glad you told us.
Somewhere around there's a transcription of my taking them on.
Yeah.
I mean, I was... So we finished?
Oh, we've gotten to the end of SEODAP, huh?
I guess, unless you... talk about some more things.
No, well, we're done with SEODAP. I suppose we should think about strategy. I would like to do more about your return to government, heading the ARC, OTI, CSAT, right, that kind of stuff. Do you want me to go away for a little while, give you a break?
You want to have a cup of coffee?
That would be great.
Let's see if I can make some.